540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Staples.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. U.S. Supreme Court justices hear arguments on two challenges to President Biden's student loan forgiveness program. U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar representing the Biden administration.
It was critical relief that was rushed out at the beginning of this devastating pandemic to ensure that we didn't see spikes in delinquency and default across the nation.
More from CBS's Jan Crawford.
There is deep skepticism among those conservative justices who think that on something this major, $500 billion, 43 million people possibly affected, that there is no way that that's not something that Congress should also be involved in, that the White House just can't go off and do this kind of major issue, policy issue on its own.
In California, officials have ended the state of emergency resulting from the COVID crisis. CBS's Steve Futterman.
In March of 2020, in the early days of the pandemic, Governor Gavin Newsom declared
a state of emergency in the state of California.
At that time, only 53 people in the state had tested positive. Today, the number is more than 11 million. Newsom says the state of emergency is able to end because California is better prepared. There is also a COVID vaccine. California currently has the 11th lowest COVID death rate in the country. Steve Futterman, CBS News, Los Angeles.
GM is cutting some salaried and executive jobs. WWJ's Jeff Gilbert in Detroit.
GM not characterizing the cuts as layoffs, rather saying it's part of a cultural shift to become more performance-oriented and accountable. No specifics, but the company's using the word small numbers to describe the cuts. They come as GM looks to cut $2 billion in costs over the next 2 years.
A Florida man accused of killing three people in a series of shootings last week will face additional first-degree murder charges. 19-year-old Keith Melvin Moses had already been charged with the murder of a woman in the Orlando suburb of Pine Hills. He'll now face murder charges in the deaths of a TV reporter and a 9-year-old girl. Orange County Sheriff John Mina.
I just think that when people continue to be arrested over and over again, they just need to be held accountable.
In California and Nevada, a blizzard warning for the western slopes of the Sierras and winter storm warning for areas including Lake Tahoe and Reno continues until early tomorrow morning. Meantime, the Northeast sees its first significant snow. CBS's Errol Barnett reports from Bristol, Connecticut.
Now, the next danger here in the Northeast is the temperature. With the mercury dropping below freezing, it means that roads that otherwise might appear wet could be hiding black ice. Drivers will need to move carefully.
Stocks fall on Wall Street. The Dow closes down 232 points. This is CBS News.
Staples stores are a new world of possible with innovative tools for small business and remote workers and learners. Explore more at your local Staples store.
WAUK 540 AM, Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. There's a bill in the Wisconsin legislature for 5-year mandatory minimum sentences for felons caught with having guns illegally. Felons aren't supposed to have guns in Wisconsin, but many still do. The bill gets its first hearing today before the Assembly Committee on Criminal Justice and Public Safety. Governor Evers would move bar time in much of southeast Wisconsin back to 4 in the morning during the Republican National Convention next year. And not just for Milwaukee, but for 14 counties, from Madison to Sheboygan to Beloit to Fond du Lac. The RNC will be in Milwaukee from July 15th through the 18th next year. In sports, the Bucks hope to make it 15 wins in a row tonight at Brooklyn. Marquette plays at Butler. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Hey everybody, how we doing? I'm Charlie Behrens, inviting you to join me Saturdays and or Sundays at noon. It's a horse apiece, whatever you decide. We're doing the Cripes Cast, where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest, and it's more fun than a six-pack of Jolly Good. Okay, the pride of Random Lake, that Jolly Good is. Anyway, it's on your Civic Media station and the Civic Media app. And do me a favor, yeah, tell your folks I says hi. Okay, real good.
Governor Tony Evers, Tim Michaels said you had gone, quote, full woke. Dr. Jill Underlie said that somebody who says that has no idea what we're doing in schools to make sure kids feel safe.
We want to make sure all kids feel supported. Tim Michaels, we don't teach CRT in our schools. You got to come to the present century here, Tim, and be cognizant of what actually goes in the schools. My guess is you've never been in a public school in Wisconsin.
Up North News Radio with Pat Krylo airs at its new time from 6 to 8 a.m. weekdays across Civic Media.
Earl Ingram.
I mean, for heaven's sakes, anybody who's heard Congresswoman Bobart from Colorado and Marjorie Taylor Greene and others, you just have to ask the question, if I'm a Republican, why would I continue to support that foolishness?
Asking the tough questions, searching for the answers we're all looking for. The Earl Ingram Show. Weekday mornings 8 to 11 on Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
The Shaw 101 FM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24-7 at waukradio.com. A progressive voice from Beaver Dam to Kenosha. WAUK 540 AM. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
From some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Today's a very important day for those folks, the chosen few, the tippy top of the economic mountain, folks making $1 million a year or more, earned income, mind you, people who collect a paycheck. If you make $1 million a year, today is the day you no longer have to pay any more Social Security tax going forward. Today's the day you have contributed everything that you're going to for the entire year. Now, the other 94-95% of the country, sorry, you're going to contribute every day for the rest of the year, because while the cap has gone up a little bit, we're up to $160,200, the vast majority of working people, well under $160,000. And look, I've never been able to get away from paying into Social Security. Not that I want to. Social Security is an incredible program. It is worth saving. It's worth defending. It's worth expanding. Which is why the right is losing their mind, because they can't destroy it and profitize it. But this is one of those moments where having the conversation of how we fund our most important, most successful anti-poverty program in the history of civilization is a good time. Today, a good time. Because when you have a percentage of the population who today's the last day, they're going to spend a dime. Now, understand, you've got the Elon Musks of the world who pay nothing into Social Security because they don't collect a paycheck. We've got our billionaire class who literally pays nothing, which we should be having a conversation on how we fund, again, the most vital, most important, most successful anti-poverty program ever devised. Maybe we should be talking about that. But the thing is when they put these caps in place, weren't there before. Thank you, Ronald Reagan. Thank you, 1983. No one really in that moment, because again, the people who were, you have to put yourself in the moment. I remember 1983. We were still seeing wage increases somewhat. The 70s had slowed things. The end of the 70s had slowed things. But from the end of World War II, you know, through the mid 70s, wages and productivity, they walked hand in hand. So the more productive companies were, the more profits they earned, the more their workers earned. Because unions were much stronger, they sat down, they negotiated for a portion of the wealth that labor created. And it was a successful partnership. Capital got what they wanted, more. Workers got what they needed, better wages, hours, conditions. Employers got what they needed, more profits. consumers got what they needed, quality products. It seemed like a pretty good, pretty workable, pretty manageable system. And then the greed. Then the billionaires. Then our titans of industry decided, no, we want more. We're better. We're smarter. And you know, I remember having a conversation with my grandfather. And this is one of those things that just really, it really illustrates how this all came about. This idea that working people could have successful lives and could, through their labor, be able to support their families and do better and enjoy not just an existence, you know, the old, you know, 1912 bread and roses idea that, yeah, bread, yes, bare minimum, you know, existence, a house, food on the table, but roses too, some of the nice things. And I had remembered, you know, years ago having a conversation as the union busting was ramping up. This was years after Patco. This was years of union decline. And I remember going, you know, back in your day, you know, things were going forward. You know, unions were expanding. Workers had more power. And he said, he told me a story about he decided for one of the anniversaries. And I don't remember which one. They were married forever, you know, 50, 60 years. He said, you know, the one year, your grandmother wanted to go see this play, and we, you know, wanted to do the dinner at the top of the town, which was the big restaurant in Cleveland at the time. It was up in the tower. You could look down on the city. It was a really, you know, swanky place, and he had saved up for it for a while. This was not something that was just, hey, we're going to do this on a Friday night. This was a real special occasion. So he did the things that you have to do, and I give him credit because man brain goes, what, I got to make reservations? He actually did that. Bought the tickets, made the reservations, did all that stuff, showed up on time, you know, very solid working class ethic. And they went to the top of the town where the restaurant was. And his boss was there. And his boss's wife was there. And my grandfather and my grandmother got seated right away because they had reservations. The boss evidently didn't think, maybe we should have reservations. Just showed up and was, as my grandfather remembered it, visibly miffed by the fact that this is what was going on. So my grandmother and grandfather, they have dinner. You know, they leave. They go over to where the play is. They get there early. They get seated early. You know, they're enjoying the evening. You know, not thinking anything more about what happened at dinner. But they notice that there are two seats next to them. And this, again, if anyone who knows me knows the Smith cloud, I know exactly where I got it. I got it from my grandfather. Because there are two seats empty. The curtain, the lights go down, the curtain goes up, and all of a sudden you hear a kerfluffle on the aisle, and people are, you know, under their breath, you know, get here on time. And you know, just this kind of anger. And you know who it is. It's the boss and his wife. They came, they had to get there late because, you know, they got to dinner. They didn't get seated till later. And he remembered at that moment, he said, you know, I remember thinking at that moment, I'm going to pay for this because this will not go unpunished. And he said, the reality is the rich and powerful don't want us around. They don't want the dirty, unwashed masses. They don't want the people who have dirt under their fingernails around. They want us to do their work, make them their profit, clean up after them, but not in the same spaces that they entertain. And again, this is going back into the 60s. And you know, he was telling me this story. And the more I think about that story, the more this is the world we're in. And what happened is corporate America said, no, we don't want the dirty rabble having, you know, access to, you know, good wages and health care and retirement security that we bestow upon them. This idea that we give them these things without the understanding that without the labor of those people who show up every day, punch the clock, do the work, you know, blood, sweat, tears, all of that stuff, there's no profit for them. Because there's no profit genie. They just rub a lantern and money comes. There's no cash trees. There's none of that. It's working people putting their blood, sweat, and tears into things. And what's happened over these last 40 plus years is we have seen an assault, really an all-out assault on wages, an all-out assault on workers as their defined benefit pension plans were stolen and divested, as their health care has been shifted from employers paying it to now, oh, got to have skin in the game. And they've trained a working class. And I go back to my grandparents. You know, they were trained to believe that they had the power to make lives better. You know, my grandfather started, you know, on a coal truck shoveling coal 12 hours a day for 17 cents an hour. It wasn't until the FDR years that they made a 25-cent minimum wage. And it was because of the unions that they were able to buy their first home and to retire with dignity, raise their children, and do all that stuff. So in 1983, understand, that generation grew up believing that what they had built was going to continue. That, yes, you're going to share in the wealth that your labor creates. Of course. Of course we're not going to have CEOs making 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 times what the average worker makes. Of course that's never going to happen. And yet here we are 40 years later, and you go, holy blank, look at what they've done. When the top 1% has seen their wealth grow almost 1,000 times, and the bottom 90% has barely seen their standard of living keep up, let alone grow. So understand, in 1983, when they put this cap in place, you know, very, very, you know, a handful of people were at that cap. And the rich people, they were paying into it too, because they hadn't figured out quite yet how to game the system. Now, you give them the incentive, well, they figured it out all right. The difference is we, the voting populace, we never kept up. We never said, this is what we demand. Which is why I've been saying for years, we need to scrap the cap entirely. And we need to make all income, income. Whether you get it from gambling on Wall Street, whether you won it in the lottery, whether you it fell from heaven like manna from heaven. All of that should go into funding, again, the most prosperous, the most secure, the most successful anti-poverty program ever. But our friends on the right can't have that. So what you see Republicans doing is now we want to talk about, they're going to talk about raising the age. We're going to make it so that you don't get it. So you don't live long enough to get it. Without talking about the main thing, which is how do we get those people like the folks today who the last day they're going to pay into it to continue to pay for the entire year? How do we make sure that the folks who like Elon Musk who get away with not paying anything put something in? But that's not what Republicans are talking about. They're talking about raising we're gonna raise the age. But that's not a cut. No, it's not a cut. And they'll tell you, we're not cutting Social Security. No, we're saving it. We're making it more secure for the future so that you never get it now. And they're calling this idea of, you know, lengthening the time before you can get to it being budget neutral. Oh, you gotta love the language. I mean, it is quite remarkable the things that they get away with. And it comes down to we don't hold them accountable. And this is one of those times where I'm hoping, you know, as this Social Security discussion ramps up, because remember, you know, Biden did that thing at the State of the Union, got all the Republicans to agree. No, we would never. How dare you think we would cut Social Security? We'd never do so. No! And yet, it's what their fantasy has been for decades. It's who they are. It's what they want. It's what they'll do. So today, an important day, and I think a day of activism, saying, look, you know, we want to defend Social Security. We want to expand Social Security. We want to make sure that it's there for future generations. Full disclosure, I've been very fortunate over the years. I actually collected Social Security as a child. When my mother passed at 13, it was the survivor's benefit. It was the Social Security that she wasn't going to get that helped my grandparents support me for the years from 13 to 18. Oddly enough, something that Paul Ryan, former Speaker of the House, one of the young guns with McCarthy and Cantor, who evidently, did keg stands wanting to destroy Social Security and Medicare. It's something we share because we both lost a parent and both collected Social Security. The difference is we both climbed the ladder. I want to make sure that we make the ladder wider so more people can get up it, as where he wants to burn it down. That, I guess, not surprising when you look at the side of the aisle. But we're in a moment right now where Social Security is going to be the bedrock of retirement for the next generation because, again, corporate America has, between you and me, really screwed a generation of workers by stealing their pensions, and there's nothing at the end of the road. And this way, if they can destroy Social Security, you never leave the workforce. It's brilliant. Work until you die. I want to hear your thoughts. What should we do with Social Security? Do you believe that we could put it into Wall Street and let the gamblers get a hold of it? Pay a little vig to the house in the hopes that maybe it's better? Or do we continue to strengthen it, expand it, demand more of our wealthy, the ones we've bestowed all of the riches possible upon? I'm going with scrap the cap. But you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Love to hear your thoughts.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I had a conversation earlier today with a friend who we're talking about Joe Biden. And I said, look, I love what Joe Biden has done as president. He was not my first choice. In fact, he wasn't my second choice. He wasn't my third choice. May have been fourth, more likely fifth. First choice was Bernie Sanders. I've always been a big Bernie Sanders choice, a big fan. Jay Inslee was my second choice. Loved his idea of the just transition for the Green New Deal. This idea of moving to renewable energy. This idea of moving us in a direction that's going to transition to where we need to go energy-wise, but do it in a way that working people don't take it on the chin. Look, the reality is I was interviewed not too long ago and someone, asked me if I was in favor of the Green New Deal and transitioning. And I said, yeah, as long as working people don't take it on the chin, as we do in every transition. This is one of those moments where you go, if we can figure out how to move in a direction that the working people don't get screwed and the wealthy get wealthier, then yeah, I'm all in favor of it. But until we can figure that out, I don't know how it happens. Because the reality is most working people, they're trying to figure out how to pay yesterday's light bill. They don't have time to think about tomorrow. They're worried about keeping the jalopy of a car on the road today to get to work. Because if they lose their job, they're out of a house. So, if we can figure out how to deal with that, then yeah, all in favor. But until you get there, and Inslee had a plan. And this is where, I go, whatever happened to Jay Inslee? I would have thought that Biden would have maybe made him the energy czar or something. But anyway, my main point was I like what Biden's done. And I look at what he's doing now with the the chips money that's going to the semiconductor industry. They're saying, yeah, we're going to build the semiconductor industry up. We're going to build the plants. But while you're building this, and I love this, while you're building this, you've got to provide high quality, guaranteed, affordable, high quality childcare for the workers who build the facilities and the workers who operate the facilities. Again, this is using federal dollars to set the bar, to set to draw a line in the sand and say, corporate America, you're going to help these workers. I love the fact that we've finally got someone who understands and is pushing us to use our tax dollars and to use our investments in a way to make working people's lives better. This a good thing. Just my thought. Want to hear yours. Let's go to the phones. Got Alice on one. Alice, how are you?
Oh, I'm hanging in there. What I wanted to say was the Republican Party wanting to get rid of Social Security, and it's not an entitlement. We pay into it. But the big thing, I believe, is you know, they realize that, oh, my goodness, these people, you know, we can't work them until the day they die. And I think that's really what it basically is.
Yep. No, I mean, ask a construction worker, you know, who's in his late 50s, early 60s. Can you make it to 70? Most of them will tell you, no, the body's worn out. You know, ask a nurse who's had to lift people out of bed and deal with that. Can you make it to 70? No. It's unfathomable that you would make these working people work until they're 70. Even 67, I think, for a lot of industries is too long. But this is the direction we're going.
Oh, absolutely. And they keep raising the when my dad retired back in the 70s, it was 65. And now they just keep raising it. It's crazy. But have a good evening, Rick.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it. No, I mean, this is the reality of the moment we're in. And this is why I like what Biden's done. Look, like I said, wasn't my first choice. But doing the things that I think are fantastic. For instance, I point to the latest fit that Grover Norquist is having. You know Grover Norquist, the guy who said he wants government so small he can drag it in the bathtub and drown it. He is so ticked off at the Biden nominee for labor secretary to replace Marty Walsh. He tweeted out, Biden's labor nominee, Julie Sue, is a threat to independent contractors and freelancers nationwide. And, you know, he's going, look, you know, 90% of independent contractors in California were against AB5. For those who don't know, AB5 was it was the independent contractor bill that actually put some language into, are you truly an independent contractor? There was the ABC test that basically just said, you know, are you someone who controls your own work? Do you do your own work? Does the person that you're working for have direct control over your movements? Is what you're doing what the employer normally does? For instance, you know, if you know, you're talking about a trucking company, you know, or you're talking about a warehouse, and they want to bring in warehouse workers. And they say, we're going to bring you in as an independent contractor. You can't do that. You hire people for that. Now, if you need an electrician to come in and wire the light bulbs, that is an independent contractor. It's a guy who's going to come in, going to do a specific job outside of your normal scope of business, have a direct contract. You're going to pay that person. It's going to be a period of time, and they're done. They're gone. They're done. On to the next job. They have complete control over their work environment. That's what an independent contractor was supposed to be. What people like Grover want is they want everybody to be an independent contractor. Everybody's going to be their own boss. And I see how well that has worked out in the trucking industry. Because as I say all the time, having spent my entire working life in the trucking industry, we try out all the bad ideas on truck drivers. Because a lot of the times they're so divided and hard to organize that it's easy to heap bad things on them. Deregulation being one of the big things. Are you going to be your own boss? Absolutely. I'm going to get my own truck and I'm going to run to the wheels, fall off of them. And what we find out is it's basically a sweatshop on wheels. You're basically working for a company, following their rules, wearing their uniform, going where they tell you, when they tell you, how they tell you. But you're your own boss. It's quite remarkable. Now, the reason I love this Julie Hsu is she's pushing back on this. Again, returning to a time where work was rewarded, where not everybody was their own boss.
WAUK 540 AM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
CBS News Brief. The Supreme Court hears two arguments questioning the constitutionality of President Biden's trillion-dollar student loan forgiveness program. Opponents, which include attorneys general from six states, say the action requires the approval of Congress. CBS News legal contributor Jessica Levinson on one of the main arguments.
The Secretary of Education simply overstepped that there was not executive authority for this particular action.
General Motors is cutting jobs, no specific numbers. WWJ's Jeff Gilbert.
A statement from GM saying a relatively small number of executives and salaried workers were let go after a performance calibration.
19-year-old Keith Melvin Moses of Florida, who's accused of killing a woman in the Orlando suburb of Pine Hills during a series of shootings last week, has also been charged with first-degree murder in the deaths of a 9-year-old girl and a TV reporter. Orange County Sheriff John Mina.
It was extremely important to bring these charges forward.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
WAUK 540 AM, Brookfield's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Navnair. Here's what you need to know. The election for Wisconsin's newest member of the state Supreme Court is just weeks away on April 4th. GOP-backed candidate Dan Kelly is endorsed by the state's three top anti-abortion groups, Wisconsin Right to Life, Wisconsin Family Action, and Pro-Life Wisconsin. Democratic-backed candidate Janet Protasiewicz has run as a vocal supporter of abortion rights. Neither have said exactly how they would rule when the challenge to Wisconsin's abortion ban comes before the court. A November poll from Marquette University Law School found only 37% of respondents supported the U.S. Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortions. The same poll showed 84% support exceptions for rape and incest. Those exceptions are not included in Wisconsin's abortion ban from 1849, which was enacted just 1 year after receiving statehood. I'm Jane Matnair. This is Civic Media News.
The Civic Media team would like to say congratulations. More than 200 Wisconsin businesses and nonprofits are receiving a free advertising campaign through our one-day $1 million advertising giveaway. If you missed out, our local sales team would still love to help you with your own campaign. Go to civicmedia.us and click on the sponsorship tab. Again, civicmedia.us and sponsorship. New and still growing, advertise today with a Civic Media network of radio stations.
This is Pat Greitlow from Up North News Radio. On the air, online, or on demand, make it a point to catch the first word on Wisconsin news, sports, and more weekday mornings from 6 to 8 all across the stations of the Civic Media Radio Network.
I was just curious as to why you called it the Paul Revere Show.
The Paul Revere Show is named this way because the poem that we all know, the famous ride, the poem was written to rally the troops to fight slavery and fight for democracy. And so I named the show the Paul Revere Show because I thought it was the time to get on the air and talk about democracy.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m., always on the Civic Media app.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bride.
J.R. Radcliffe is coming back to the show. The timeline of Brett Favre's involvement in a welfare scam in Mississippi.
Brett Favre's camp has denied all wrongdoing. Like, he really feels like he did nothing wrong. So I guess he's a little burned by that.
Celebrating all things Wisconsin. As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bride. Weekdays 11 to 2 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
That's a corporate claim that executives have an inalienable right to endanger workers. This is Jim Hightower saying, sure enough, bowing to the corporate powers, Ohio lawmakers rejected the safety bill. And that, boys and girls, is why train catastrophes keep happening.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, as I said, the reality is today for those making over $1 million a year, the last day that they're going to be paying into Social Security. And I don't think that's right. I think we need to devise a system, well, where we're all paying into it. Because as I said at the beginning, this is the most successful, the best anti-poverty program ever devised. And as a society, if we're not going to let people die on the streets, if we don't want granny going back to eating cat food and living in indigent warehouse kind of nursing homes like I remember as a kid, Social Security is one of those things I think we need to hold on to. And here to share some thoughts on today, the big story today, I've asked my good friend Alex Lawson to come share some thoughts. He's the executive director of Social Security Works, socialsecurityworks.org, their website. Alex, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, as always.
So this is the big day with those fortunate who are making over $1 million a year. This is the last day they're going to have to pay any Social Security whatsoever. They've made it to the end.
Yeah, it's true. If you make $1 million a year today, from this point forward, you're not going to pay another nickel into Social Security. And, you know, the rest of us pay in all year long. And that's the reality, is that for the vast majority of the American people, I think something like 94%, you know, they're going to pay in on all of their income. And some people, you know, some people who are making just over $160,000, you know, there are some geographic places where, you know, I don't think, you know, I think there's a case to be made for, you know, not hitting maybe the dollars right above $160,000, which is the current cap. But you look at someone like Elon Musk, you know, that guy probably stops paying in on like the first second of January 1st. And there's no reason that he shouldn't be paying into the system on all of his income, his earned income, his wages, and his unearned income, because that's how the billionaires have been getting their money around the Social Security system. It's not just the cap,
right?
Which makes the funding of Social Security incredibly regressive, right? I mean, like, really, it's very abnormal in our system to have a tax that actually tax, you know, minimum wage workers up to a point, and then billionaires are like, you know, the richer you are, the smaller the tax is. Makes no sense. So, you know, the remedy to this situation is so obvious. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren just introduced it in the Senate, Jan Schakowsky in the House. John Larson has his bill in the House. They're slightly different, but the concepts are the same. We expand Social Security benefits for everyone, and we pay for it by just getting millionaires and billionaires to pay in on all of their income, just like the rest of us. You know, one of the questions between the two versions is just, do you exempt people up to $250,000, so from $160,000 to $250,000, or do you go up to $400,000. So in Sanders-Warren bill, it's everyone making over $250,000. And in Larson's version, it's $400,000. But that's a fine debate to have, right? Yep. We call those in D.C. a conferenceable difference. Those are two very good pieces of policy. And if we pass them in the House and the Senate, we'll bring them together and we'll create a third one where we take the best parts from both of them. But it's not a dire situation, Rick. You know that. But, you know, like, what the billionaires are selling is that Social Security is the issue. That's not true. The billionaires are the issue, right? Social Security is fine. It's just the billionaires' criminal greed is hurting, you know, the world, and is hurting very specifically the Social Security system. But we know exactly how to fix it.
Yeah. And the other part that I brought up, because I said at the beginning that Elon Musk doesn't pay anything, because I don't know that he actually collects a salary. I think right. We need to discuss what income is. It's just not the wage income that you're paid in a paycheck. It should be everything that comes in. And then, look, you know, the reality is a lot of people don't have realized income. You know, you look at these people, Musk's worth, you know, gazillions of dollars in stock and has all this wealth. There's got to be a way that we say, you know, some of that is used to help you know, the folks who really created that wealth, you know, the working people who go up every day and actually do the work that creates that wealth.
Yeah, there's, you know, there's a lot of creative ways of going after unearned income as well. You know, capital gains. You know, the truth is, as you know, Rick, the bosses have an army of lawyers who their whole job is to just get the loot around the system so that they don't pay in. They pay as little as possible in, and the difference is they have an army of lawyers devising, I wish I remembered the details, but like one time Elon Musk was able to put billions of dollars into an IRA through some super tricky setup that basically Congress had to specifically disallow this one thing. And it was billions of dollars. And so like his lawyers, you know, they got paid money to find those loopholes. But when you're playing with billions of dollars, that's what it comes down to. So but again, it's not that hard to find how you go after that income. I mean, I have a personal favorite, Thomas Paine, founding father. He wrote about it in Agrarian Justice, one of the first pamphlets that promoted an American form of social insurance. And his was funded with the estate tax. I think the estate tax is one of the most fair taxes there is. It's not even on a person. It's on the estate after they pass.
Oh, and you mean the death tax. You're talking death tax. See, here you go. Death and taxes again.
But, you know, everybody does die. And without a functioning state, there is no estate. Right? It is literally a legal construct that is entirely created because of the society and the system of laws that we live in. So, I mean, you can do really... You know, you can do anything when it comes to policy. So why not, you know, a 99% estate tax on estates over $5 billion? You know, like, I mean, who's going to argue against that? I'm sure people with $6 billion. But you can do a lot of things. But the thing that we can't do is let this same system continue.
Right.
Because the inherent contradictions in it are really approaching that place where the system is starting to fail, and political collapse is a thing. I don't see it, you know, imminent in America, but you get wafts of it coming through, like an attempted coup during, you know, one of the years of the most unrest from, you know, police violence against the Black community, communities of color, and COVID and lockdown. I mean, there's so much going on. That was a knife's edge. And really, democracy could have been lost. American democracy could have been lost on January 6th. That sort of instability, that the society is out of balance, that can't continue. And there's only one cause of it. Again, Social Security is not the issue. It's definitely not public education that is causing social dislocation. It's the billionaires. It's the fact that their greed knows no bounds. It's the fact that, you know, they lobbied, they spent ungodly amount of money to remove any safety regulations, like just having functioning brakes on trains that carry toxic chemicals, when everyone was saying, this is gonna result in a disaster. And they're like, I don't care. I can make a little bit more money so I can buy another yacht. And that's what they're focused on.
Yep.
And what do we then have? A disaster. And who pays? The workers. Who was the one? Who were the ones ringing the alarm bell? It was the unions. It was the workers being like, this system is going to crumble. It can't handle the stress of what it has to do transporting these chemicals. You know, professional labor, very, very professional labor, and satisfy the greed of the billionaire class.
Yeah, the greed knows
one or the other.
No, I remember the arguments of the 80s that if we just gave all the smart people all the money, they would know what to do with it, and then it would trickle down to the rest of us. I still remember I had a college professor explain it to me, and I'm going, it doesn't make any sense, because what's going to make it trickle down? Nothing. And it's what is exactly worked out. A handful of people have controlled all the wealth, and wages have been stagnant and declining for 40 years. Healthcare security's been robbed from us. Retirement security's all but gone. And Social Security's that one last thing. And you've got a generation who believes they're going to see a UFO before they see a Social Security check. So how do we turn that around then? Because, again, it comes back to messaging. And the right has done a great job of saying, no, we need to push, we need to make the retirement age 70 and it's budget neutral. This isn't a cut. No, it's a cut. It's a three-year cut. How do we turn that around?
It's a 21% benefit cut for everyone. So I think it is messaging, but I think more it's organizing. And it has to be the same sort of organizing that we're seeing in labor that has a bit more militancy than we've seen previously. It really needs to be people standing up like you saw in France. In France, they just tried to raise the retirement age, which, again, it's not to do with what age you retire. You can retire at whatever age you feel you have enough resources to live at the standard of living that you want in what you consider retirement. The so-called retirement age is just a formula that we use to calculate how much your benefits are going to be. So it's the question, not at the age at which you retire, but at how much can you retire on? And you know, you have these guys, the Rick Allen, we got this video of him. He's like, oh, I think people want to work longer. They're telling me they want to work to 70. That dude's worth like $50 million. So like, yeah, I don't know who you're talking to, but that's not people out in America. They definitely don't want to work till they're 70. And everyone else doesn't want a 20% benefit cut.
Yep. Let's ask the person who has to clean up after him. If that person wants to work till they're 70, cleaning up after his
Exactly.
Person.
Exactly. And that's what it comes down to, I think, is that there is a timidness in what I think, like, the institutional left, I don't know what to call it, but it's a timidness to point out that all of the things that you said, stagnant wages, crumbling healthcare, right? Coverage going away, defined benefit pension plans eliminated, hospitals closing in rural areas like clockwork now. It's just accelerating. And, you know, that is bad. But it's like we tell the story without saying who's doing it, who benefits from all of those things. Everything I just said makes people billionaires.
Yep.
That's how they do it. It's just wealth extraction. They don't create anything. They're just extracting wealth from the people. And so, yes, the problem isn't Social Security. The problem isn't public education. These things work. Medicare works. The problem is the billionaires. You can't do two things at the same time. You can't provide guaranteed health care for everyone in this country and have a handful of CEOs who make more money than can be spent in, you know, generations. You can't do both of those at the same time. And even if you stay like firmly in a capitalist system, you're like, okay, fine. You can make money off of things, but you can't make money off of people's lives. You can't make money off of holding people hostage with the insulin that they need every day, just like we need oxygen every day. With insulin vials that were invented over 100 years ago, in my eyes, you can't have a system that allows a billionaire to hold that vial behind their back and say, you're not getting it unless you pay me every penny that you have and every penny that you can borrow. And then maybe I'll give you some and I'm going to increase the price next year.
Yeah, no, it's what we talked about yesterday. In fact, Wendell Potter has a new report out that said that, you know, the big insurance revenues and profits from 2012 till now, the last decade, have gone up, you know, revenue up 300%, profits up 287%, that they profited almost $70 billion. And that's beyond all of the CEO costs, all the labor costs, you know, everything. That's pure profit in their pockets that didn't go to healthcare. And, you know, and then you tell me, hey, we can't cover people. We can't get free insulin. We can't make sure that people get the life-treating life-saving treatments that they need. It's ridiculous. But then it comes back to taking on that greed. So again, I come back to the last question I've got, because this is a political issue. This comes back to us organizing. This comes back to us, you know, standing together and taking off the red hats and the blue hats and figuring out, maybe putting on a hard hat and rebuilding some things. Do you see that possible?
I do. I think it'll take hard hats, seniors, students, workers across the country standing together. And I know sometimes Americans don't like to watch global news, but if you look at what the French working people did when their elites said, oh, well, we're going to just take away, they were just trying to take their, the full benefit age to where it is in America, 67. And the whole country stood up and was like, the hell you are.
I thought they wanted to go to 64. I thought they wanted to go from 62 to 64.
I thought, you know what? I bet you you're totally correct. And I just couldn't conceive in my brain that our system was so much worse than where they are. Our first retirement age is 62, the earliest you can claim benefits. And then it goes up, you know, your benefits go up every year that you delay claiming benefits. But to the political issue, that's what it's going to take. Yeah. Politicians are never the answer. They're lagging indicators. It's going to take a popular movement, and it does have to be intergenerational. It has to be, you know, interracial, all ethnicities, all races, working people. That's where the mass of people are. And just remember that there's hundreds of billionaires in this country, and there's hundreds of millions, 350 million people in this country. So the reason that things like the disaster in East Palestine happen is not because of the people. It's because of a system that's been corrupted to advance and enrich a few hundred people. And so when you look at it in those terms, yes, they have a lot of money, but they don't have a lot of people. So we've got people, and that's how we win.
We've out-procreated them. We just have to come together. And to steal a line from Rupert Murdoch, it's not about red or blue, it's about green.
That is Rupert Murdoch's entire outlook on life. And I do hope that a bunch of that green transfers from News Corp or Fox, whatever his corporate entity is, right into the coffers of Dominion, because I think that it's such a clear case where this corporation, in order to advance false propaganda that enriched them, put the people working in this just totally random company completely at risk.
Yep. You know, so like, it's all about the money.
All about the money.
All about the money. But Alex, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
Our good friend Alex Lawson. Make sure you check out the work they do over at Social Security Works. SocialSecurityWorks.org, the website. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1942. That was the day that Sue Cowan Williams filed a lawsuit for equal pay for black teachers in Little Rock, Arkansas. 86 black teachers worked in the city's segregated school system. They were all members of the Little Rock Classroom Teachers Association. In 1941, the teachers formed a salary adjustment committee to look into pay discrimination. What they found there was a wide gap between black and white salaries. The average white elementary school teacher made $526 a year, while the black teacher earned only $321. White high school teachers brought home $856 a year, while black teachers only made $567. Backed with this research, the committee presented a petition to the school board demanding an end to pay discrimination. The board tabled the petition, and that summer passed another round of unequal pay raises. The teachers then approached the NAACP and asked them to handle their case. Thurgood Marshall agreed to take up the lawsuit. Marshall would go on to become the first black U.S. Supreme Court justice. Sue Cowan Williams, the head of the English department at Dunbar High School, was selected as the plaintiff for the case. The teachers lost their lawsuit and then won on appeal, but Williams paid a price for her involvement. The next school year, the school district did not renew her contract. She was finally rehired to teach at Dunbar a decade later. But first, the school's superintendent called Williams to ask her if she had, quote, learned her lesson. It was a lesson that many workers have learned, that there is often a high personal cost for standing up for justice on the job. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It is all about the greed. You know, Alex is absolutely right. It's about the greed. And, you know, I remember growing up during that, the greed is good era. You know, the ones who dies with the most toys wins. You know, the trickle-down era that, you know, we're gonna give the rich people all they want. And they, in turn, they're going to take care of us. And anybody feeling okay with that? Because again, every one of the institutions that our great grandparents and our grandparents' generations built, strong unions to fight for better wages, hours, conditions from the wealth that your labor creates, health insurance that when you get sick, you get cared for, and not the kind of, hey, how much can you pay? Not pay or die health insurance, but actually, here's my card. I need help. And retirement security. The kind of institutions that were a social safety net in government that the unlucky who aren't going to fall through the cracks. And Republicans have done their foolhardy best to, well, destroy all of that. All in the name of greed and more for the handfuls. And you see this played out in instance after instance. And, you know, the explosion in Ohio, well, the couple of explosions in Ohio, perfect examples. We've deregulated because, oh, the regulations are costly. It's going to take money out of the wealth class's pocket. There won't be as much dividends to be handed out. You know, job-killing regulations, Rick. You know, what do we need, you know, 4, 5, 6 people on a train for when we can have 3, maybe 2, maybe 1, maybe none? Wouldn't it be great if we had no one on that train? Same thing comes up for, you know, the future, you know. And we're going to hear the rollouts for automation. And look, automation is going to come. I'm not a Luddite. I think it's going to happen. We just have to figure out how working people, again, don't get screwed over and over. I go to the local checkout at the grocery store. I was there today. Do you know the checkout counter where the person is now the shortest line? Because they've already trained us to go to the self-checkouts. And I'm going, wow. And did the prices come down? Oh, no. No, they didn't. You know, that one item that I planned on spending $8 ended up costing me 70. Who benefits from that? You know, follow the money. You know, Cicero's Cui Bono, to whose benefit? It's always the handful. It's always the rich and powerful. And as long as they can keep us pitted against each other, fighting over red hats and blue hats, fighting over, you know, nonsense characters, they're going to continue to rob us blind. And this is one of my great frustrations, because we get into these silos and we bomb each other. And I'm going to score my point because I'm right. Instead of going, how do we fix this situation? How do we do what the greatest generation did? And, you know, I used to fight back against my grandparents' generation being the greatest generation, arguing, look, their backs were against the wall. They had no choice. But when you sit back and look at what they did, they built for the future. Not just their future, but the future of their children and their grandchildren. They built infrastructure. They invested in a safety net that made sure that people didn't fall through. And now we hear people screaming and hollering, you know, Republicans going, oh, we can't have that woke stuff. You know, like food stamps for to feed children. It's nuts. as they attempt to, again, privatize and profitize what we do for ourselves. Public education is on the chopping block. They are working diligently to profitize private public education. And the sad reality is their messaging is brilliant. These are advertising slicksters, man. These are the Madison Avenue folks. These are the focus group tested, think tank approved folks. They know the buzzwords that's going to make you go, oh, yeah.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.